Henry Jonkert of rural Namur discusses changes in farming over time. Born in 1899, he has lived on a farm near Namur all his life. The interview took place on February 24, 1976. The interviewer is Linda Green.
Leaving school, I left school at about the age of 14. Before spring work would start, in fact, we had to get ready, like fanning the grain and getting the machinery ready, and a lot of little jobs like that we had to get ready for. And then as soon as the frost was out the ground, where we'd be out on the fields. The seeding, most of the crops that were being seeded at the time were the spring grain was oats and wheat and barley and corn and peas. And the fall crops was rye and winter wheat. This was quite a lot of variety, but a few years later, most of those grain crops faded out, like barley and rye and peas. I don't know the reason why, but during 1940, at the Second World War, there was very few peas that was grown yet. And at that time, one of an agronomist from Madison had been here, and he was coaxing the people to raise more peas. The people didn't agree with that. We figured that we could get more feed by growing oats and getting more milk than by growing peas, because peas didn't crop out so good anymore. There seemed to be a lot of lice on them, and they didn't have anything to spray them at the time yet. So a lot of years we would barely get the seed out of what we seeded. We wouldn't get a return of the same amount of what we put in even. So most of the farmers quit with the peas. Then later, that was Scotch peas. And they had field peas at that time. Field peas was a little white pea. They looked kind of whitish yellow. But the Scotch peas was a green pea. They were very good for soup. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of sweet. But then most of the people didn't grow that because it was extremely lot of work. In the morning, the people would get up around 4 o'clock in the morning, and they'd have to go and bunch that pea after those peas after they were sown. See, after they were cut, they'd have to bunch that up so as to be able to load them on the wagon and bring them in the barn. And then it was hard work again to pitch them out the barn in a thrashing machine. It was lots easier with bundles. Grain bundles than it was with peas. So all in all, it was a lot more work. So then mostly why they dropped peas out. And there was no market for the peas anymore. from $7, from over $7 a bushel, peas dropped to less than $3 a bushel in about 2 or 3 years' time.
Why did the person from Madison want you to change?
He claimed that the soldiers had to have peas for food. And that was why they made him, he was trying to get the farmers to change and grow peas.
How did he try to convince you? What did he do?
Well, he just made a speech and said that with the farmers' boys going in the army too, and that they need peas to feed the army. Well, that's why he was trying to coax us to grow more peas. But we thought that we'd get more food for the soldiers if we grew more oats and got more milk and beef, which was meat and stuff like that. So that's why they quit with the peas. And then a few years later, then it was the same thing with barley. Barley was used as for malt, for beer. And they must have found out that they could use other grain or another substitute to make beer, because there's very little barley grown now. The last barley that was grown around here was all used for feed. And practically the same thing with rye. The only thing was that they kept on growing was wheat and oats. The wheat, we had a Brussels roller mills here, just about 2.5 miles from here. We'd bring the wheat there and they'd grind it into flour. The millman would take part of that flour for the pay of grinding the wheat. They average in the neighborhood of about 30 pounds of flour to a bushel of wheat. So the millman would keep part of that flour, and he'd give the rest of the flour back to the farmer with the bran and the middlings. Today, the bran alone is worth what we can get for the wheat. If we'd sell a bushel of wheat, and we'd have to buy 100 pounds of bran or 60 pounds of bran, it would just about come out even. The flour and the middling, there would be that much difference today. So that mill burned down, and then we used to all to Luxembourg, where they had another mill where they were making flour. Now, a few years ago, that same mill in Luxembourg burned down too. So now there's practically no market for wheat anymore. The wheat they have has got to be shipped out. And to ship that wheat out, it should be a carload of wheat. And very few farmers in this neighborhood can grow enough wheat to make a carload.
Could you ever put it together?
Sure, we can put it together. But there are so very few that are growing wheat. See, wheat today is only worth $3.35 for 100 pounds. I asked in Luxembourg the other day what they'd pay for wheat. That was only about the only one in around here that are still buying wheat to ship out. And he says, by all means, he says, feed your wheat if you have any wheat, he says. But I haven't got no more cattle. I can't feed the wheat I got. I gotta get rid of it. I gotta sell it. Because all I do is cash crop.
What will you do now?
Well, we gotta we oats and A will be our principal crops now. That's about the only thing we can make any money out of it to be, if it's worthwhile. Or corn. But again, corn takes a lot of different machinery. And the machinery is pretty expensive. So, as far as I'm concerned, I think a person at my age is better off to either make a deal with a neighbor so as to let him lend your land or lease your land to him if he wants to grow corn, than anything else. And hay, well, the hay we crop, as a rule, we can always sell some standing, or if we can manage to bale it and put it in the barn till fall, well, then there's always a market for the hay. There's always some places they're short of hay, and we generally have to sell it on big trucks that load about 8 or 10 tons on semis, and they haul that away from to the market where there's a good price for hay. But they have to have quite a lot of money for loading that hay. When we figure that it takes 2 men about an hour and a half to load a load of hay, and then it'll take them another hour and a half to unload that load of hay, that's 3 hours for 2 men. Plus their truck, the expenses of the truck, they got to make quite a profit on that hay. So the farmer don't really get a lot of money for the hay that he's cropped and the work he's done. And especially the last few years when twine was $35 or $40 a bale, that was pretty expensive, because out of a bale of hay, you generally get around between 400 and 425 bales of hay.
You farm with your son-in-law now.
Yeah.
How do you make the decisions together?
If you ask me, whenever my son-in-law asks me, what do you think we should put in that field? Well, I says, last year it was oats, and we could put oats this year yet, unless you want to put corn. Well, then he says, yeah, I'll be short of corn home if I can get 10, if I can put 10 acres of corn here, I'll put 10 acres of corn in here. And the rest, we'll see to oats, and the rest of the cropland will be in hay. And that's the only decision. It's all verbal agreements that we got. And I help him with the haying, I help him with the grain, I haul the grain in and I run it in the elevator and put it in the granary, and whenever he wants some to take home, well, I haul it home for him and unload it there, because we got each our own elevator, so we got him set up that we can just go from one place to another. And the same thing with hay, we can unload hay over there and unload hay here. It don't make much difference, see. And then when it comes to combining, well, he comes with, at present, he's got most of the machinery for haying. I got a baler and I got a mower and I got a side rake, but I help him out here on this place with my own machinery. And over there he runs his own machinery. But then he has a hay bind, which he cuts the hay now. and he's got a baler. Sometimes when we had enough people to do it, well, we bale at two balers to rush to work when we see it's going to rain or something, when we hustle up and we bale it with two balers.
How do you find those other people to help?
Well, he's got his father and he's got the girls. And he had a boy before he went in the Navy. So we'd have a number of wagons and we'd load all these wagons, see? Before we'd unload any, we'd probably load 6 or 7 loads a day on the wagons. And then in the evening or the next morning when the dew was heavy, we'd unload that hay in the morning. And he'd send one of the girls or the boy, he'd send them out to cut another patch of hay to get it ready for the next day or the day after. So it's not as hard making hay now as it was years ago. When I first started making hay by myself, and that I was only had my wife along, and she'd have to drive the team, and we had a hay loader, and I had to make the load alone, and then come home, take the horses out the wagon, put them back on the evener and unload, because we use a hay fork and a rope, and they'd pull that fork full of hay up in the mow, and then when they were to the end where the fork was in the mow, the horses would just turn around. They just knew when to turn around and come back to the barn. They were trained. And Ma would set the fork in the hay, and it took about 8 or 10 forkfuls of hay to unload one big load. There was about 2.5 tons of hay, or 2.5 to 3 tons of hay on the wagon then. But then I'd have to go in the mow and spread that hay, so that it would go up to against the walls too, because the air would only drop it in the middle. And pretty soon you'd be up to the top, so you had to spread it.
So it was quite a switch as far as workload went when you got married.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, up to the time before I got married, my brother Harvey was here, and we had to do all the work together. By the time I was 16, my older brothers were gone, and we hired a man to help us at that time. And we got a man here for about 3 years to help us. And
then, where was he from?
In the neighborhood. Just a man from the neighborhood. Then, when I got to be about 18 or 19, we done all the work by ourselves, just my brother and I had a younger sister. Between the three of us and my dad, that could drive the team a little bit around, like for unloading that hay and stuff like that. He could help a little bit yet, and he was doing most of that light work. And by that time, we got the first tractor, a little Ford tractor. And that was a big help. And then a few years later, when we divided the farm between my brother and I, well, then he got the Ford, and I got a McCormick Deering. It was a little heavier tractor. And after we got the tractor, we used the tractor on the wagon for loading hay. It was a much smoother job. It would never stop, and it would keep on going, and it was going always at the same speed. So it was lots easier on the person making the load. But then we started using the tractor on the binder too for cutting grain. It could go a little bit faster than the team could, and it would last longer. We could keep going all the while. We never had to give the tractor a rest. And then when we were done cutting that patch, we let the tractor and the binder stand, and we start shocking grain. After the grain was shocked, it would stay there for 2 or 3 days. Then we'd start hauling it in. We'd haul it in the barn. And later in the fall, we'd have to trash then. When it came around the October or sometime like that, we'd start trashing. The trashing crew consists of 6 men in the mow, 4 that were pitching the bundles and 2 that were shoving it to the person that was feeding the separator. Then there was 2 on the straw stack and 1 at the blower. And 4 guys to carry bags, the grain in the granary then. And sometimes when the oats was good, they really had a go at 4 to carry those bags, especially if the granary was a little ways from the barn, and they'd probably have to go upstairs too to carry that. It was a two-story granary. Well, they sure had to go with quite a speed to be back on time for the next bag.
How did you divide up the work for the crews?
For the crews, generally, a guy that was good, strong, and healthy, they'd put him to carry the bags. The younger kids that were lighter, they'd put them in the mow. And the old man with a younger kid, probably, they'd have him make the straw stack. Then the people who owned the separator and the steam engine, there was one guy to the steam engine to keep on firing the steam engine and taking care of it, and 2 of them to take care of the separator. They change hands every now and then. One guy would go up on the platform and he'd feed that separator for maybe half an hour or an hour, and then the other guy was just walking around and looking if everything was running smooth. Then he'd go on the platform and the other guy would go down and wipe the separator. Then it took one guy to haul the water for the steam engine with a water tank on a wagon, and they had one of those 2-cylinder pumps that they used to push back and forth with that handle on the cross and the crossbar on top there to pump that water. They'd have to go to, sometimes they might have to go a couple miles to go to a creek where they could find water to pump that water into that water tank. And then bring it back to the engine. If the engine would run short of water and they wanted them to be in a hurry to come back, well, they'd just blow the whistle and the team they'd have to come back with half a load probably. And then we'd have to put a few large tanks close to the engine. When they had far to go, we'd have a few barrels and a couple of tanks close to the engine where they could put the water in. If it was a real good engine, she didn't take so much water. A couple of tankfuls of water a day would have been all right. But I've seen engines that the flues were leaking and that it took 4 loads a day of water. So that was quite a lot of work for the guy who was taking care of the water.
Who were you on a thrashing crew with?
The people we had, the thrash crew. Well, at the time it was a company from Mazières that used to come out here. There were different crews, and some crews were just a bunch of farmers that had bought the machine and they just trashed their own, the members of that crowd that had bought that machine. But then again, some other crews then that had bought that machine wanted to make a little extra money to pay for that machine. So they'd go out trashing the other farmers then.
So you usually and had a crew
in the neighborhood, yeah, from the neighborhood. A machine from in the neighborhood. We've had machinery come from the trash from Dykesville already up to here. We've had some up from up in Lincoln come and trash up here at the time. There were so very few of them that they had quite a run. And then later on in fall, when the clover, if they had any clover seed to be trashed, well, they had what they call a clover hauler. It was a little different kind of a separator than the other one. They called it a hauler because it didn't have no concaves in. It would have strips of bars, and those bars would just scrape one against the other to scrape the seed out of the clover. Then there was a small fanning mill on the side of the machine where the seed would run on top of that fanning mill, and then when they were done, the seed was just as nice and clean as the seed you'd buy now from any of the seed dealers. It was cleaned all in one operation then. Some of them would try to trash out of their grain separators, like Timothy, they could trash it. But when they trashed it, it wasn't very clean. We had to run it over a fanning mill by trashing Timothy for seed. There wasn't too much of that was being done, but once in a while, a farmer couldn't be done making his hay. If we had bad weather, rainy weather, well, maybe a nice patch of hay would stay there, and it was nice, clean timothy. Well, then we'd leave it to go for seed. We'd cut it with the binder and shock it just like grain. And we'd trash it just like when we trash grain, we trash the timothy too.
Did most of the farmers get done by Kermis time?
A lot of them were lucky by Kermis time. That would be the first Sunday in September. Here in this part of the country, here in Namur and Brussels, it was the first Sunday of September. Well, there was a lot of farmers that weren't done putting the crops in by then. I remember we had to work at that time. We'd have Saturday, Sunday, and Monday as holidays for Kermis. We'd celebrate those 3 days. But I've seen times when my father would say, well, it's all right at night, but today we've got to put the grain in. Daytime. We couldn't celebrate on Monday. We'd have to haul the grain in. So the crops and the grain always came first. It's very, very seldom if they'd have worked on a Sunday, though. Very seldom. No, that time it was very seldom when we hauled hay when we worked on a Sunday.
What kinds of things did you do on Sunday?
Just the chores. And go to church and come back and loaf around. Or in the fall, probably take a gun and go hunting for an hour or so in the afternoon.
Did you have a special meal on Sunday?
Well, generally, yes. Generally, it was a little better meal on Sunday. They had more time to make it. Well, at that time for meals, when my mother was living and my older sisters were here yet, well, We had what they call those outside ovens. And my mother would bake as much as 20 or 22 bread, loaves of bread at once. And that took a lot of punching to get that, to make that bread all by hand. And when it was all done, she'd have two boards laying on the chairs, and she'd put her bread on there to rest. And after the bread was rest a certain, the way she wanted them to bake, well, then she'd each take the board on one end, at two, and carry it to that outside oven, and she'd just shove it in. She had what they call a spit, and we'd put the pan on the spit, then she'd bring it in the oven, wait to the end, and drop it there, and come back and take another one till she had them all in. And a lot of times, she'd bake 5-6 pies besides that, and all of that would go in the same oven at one time.
Once it was baked, how did you keep it fresh?
When there was 17 in the family, it didn't take long to get it all done. It would stay fresh from one time to another. Yeah.
You mentioned last time that there were thistles in the field.
Yeah, well, after we had the grain seeded, see, and the grain was about 5-6 inches high, we'd start seeing the thistles coming out. And as soon as those thistles were showing above the grain, well, then we'd go in the field at 4 or 5 of us, and we'd cut those thistles. And we all had a bag at first. When I first started, we'd have a little bag or a little container to put those thistles in, and we'd put them in the bag and bring them back when we came back for lunch, because generally we had lunch around 9 o'clock and then dinner at 12. So we'd always have a bunch of thistles to bring back, and we'd put them in a big steel kettle. We'd drop them in there, and in the evening we'd set a little fire under them. And when they were, by the time the water was real warm, all those thistles were soft and cooked like. Then we'd take a little bit of those thistles, put it in a container with a little bit of feed on, mostly just ground oats, and feed that to the few cows that were milking good.
Yeah. Okay, we're just about out of tape, so thank you.